You're listening to
the DEA Podcast.
The opinions expressed on the DEA Podcast are merely the streaming thoughts of the host and guests and should not be relied upon or acted upon without further due diligence. If you do not agree to this, then you must immediately switch off and run far, far away. Permission to republish the DEA Podcast is permitted, providing a link to the show notes is included.
Podcast at energy-performance-certificate.org.
Hi, this is part two of the DEA Podcast, episode 17 with Brian Scannell of Sava. Coming up in part two, Brian takes questions sent in by DEAs who wish to know just what is the criteria for allocating jobs to DEAs? Was the joint venture with Simply Hip a smart move? Will Sava be running courses for commercial EPCs? And how much does Sava really charge its clients? Plus, of course, much, much more. Let's join your host, Mike C. First of all, can you describe the criteria you use to allocate jobs to DEAs?
Right, this is now the Sava Business Exchange rather than NS or Sava. And I think one of the things we haven't really made clear to people is that there is a separation of roles between the Business Exchange and the rest of NES. The Business Exchange is obviously, it's a service we run. People can become part of that network. But getting back to your question, the individuals nominate which postcodes they operate under, and then in general terms, it is a just take it in turns. Work is allocated in turn. That does tend to get overridden by when individuals have negotiated a preferred inspector status with a particular estate agent or PAC provider. That can affect the allocation, because obviously if a job is coming through from a particular estate agent and they've said, I want all of my work done by Fred, then that work ends up with Fred. But in general terms, we try to distribute what work there is across the people that want to work in a particular area. Now, you know, that is a kind of desirable aim, but it can also lead to significant inefficiencies in the way things are working. And the scenario I always paint is sort of, you know, if we had two jobs come in from different estate agents, but for neighboring semi-detached properties, the way we're working at the moment would mean that those two jobs would end up going to two different individuals. And that's fair in one sense, that it's spreads work around, but it's very unproductive in another way, because you've got two sets of travel time and all the rest of it. So we are reviewing our allocation procedures, but we haven't yet concluded on where we're going to go with that. But what we do feel is that enabling individuals to operate as productively as possible is critical in the market, and we've got to figure out how to do that. Obviously, the first issue is to actually increase the volume of work. You know, productivity means nothing unless there's unless there is an increase in the volume of work. So, you know, first priority, let's see if we can get the volume of work up. Second priority, yes, we know we need to review the allocation procedures, but right at the moment, trying to spread the work out across the people in the network seems to us to be a reasonable approach to be adopting.
Okay. I got a question from Ray Fowler, who wrote, could you ask Brian to detail the costs of DEA accreditation with Sava, especially if one hasn't trained with Sava? I have looked on their website and I could only find accreditation details for home inspectors.
Right. I have to confess that our websites are perhaps not the an object lesson in easy access to information. The DEA accreditation, let me think. There is a £100 application fee, there is a £250 a year membership fee, and that's the only recurring bit. And then there is a software license fee, which is the only bit that gets that is paid additional for individuals who didn't train with us. Obviously, if somebody trained with us, they've already paid their software license fee as part of their training costs. And I should know this, but I think it is £275. But I could be wrong on that. If anyone's got any questions on those costs, they can talk to the accreditation scheme team, and the telephone number for that is 01908 540 605. And but basically, it's an application fee and an annual membership if you are a trained SAVA or NHER trained. And then in future years, it's only the membership fee that's that's repeated. And if you've trained elsewhere, then the only additional cost you face is a one-off software license fee. Again, that's not repeated in subsequent years.
Okay, he goes on to say that he'd like to know why SAVA charge for this license when most, if not all, other accreditation companies do not make this charge.
I mean, it is a choice we have made in terms of our pricing regime. You know, we think it is fair. It is a charge that individuals who have trained with us have paid. Obviously, we, you know, have to keep reviewing our prices to make sure that we are competitive in the marketplace. But we, at the moment, we think it is a fair and reasonable approach to adopt to charge that one-off license fee.
It's a thorny nettle, really, at the moment. But I've got to move on. I'm sorry. Kathy asks, if in hindsight, Brian thinks the joint venture with Simply Hip on the SAVA BX was a smart move.
Well, we committed to try to doing our best to make sure that there was a route to market for independent HIs and DEAs. And by pursuing the strategy of the joint venture with Simply, we basically increased the volume of work that would be available through that route. Now, you know, had we anticipated when we pursued that strategy that there would be quite so many different routes to market? No, we hadn't, and we didn't expect the market to be so we didn't expect the numbers of home inspectors and DEAs that exist, and as such we didn't expect the fees to have collapsed as quickly as they have. So you know, if you're asking it from the point of view, was it commercially a successful initiative? No, I mean, you know, in terms of the investment that we've had to put in to create that vehicle, we're not in any imminent danger of getting overwhelmed with a financial return from it. But in terms of where we write to do it so that home inspectors and DEAs would at least have access to a market as a safe net if things had turned out differently. Yes, you know, I mean, we promised that this would be something we would do, and we've done it. I wish the market was operating differently than it is, but I don't have any control over that. Am I glad that we've had the flack that has been thrown at us when we have been when we've reflected what was happening commercially in the marketplace? Well, nobody likes being insulted. Nobody likes being accused of lying and everything else, which is what has happened. But I, you know, we have at all times acted and been as honest as we could be within the situation that and within the information that we had at that time. I stood in front of a team of trainee home inspectors last November, I think it was, certainly months and months before it finally happened, and was saying that, you know, we all have to anticipate that the price of EPCs will fall. And at that time, I was saying that we anticipated that it would be about £75 would be the fee to a DEA come the 1st of June, as it was then. Now, you know, I was roundly criticized at that time for saying that. But, you know, and it gives me no great pleasure that in retrospect, I was overly optimistic in terms of the fees. You know, that isn't what we wanted. But we have to recognize that what's been created is a situation where there is a very low barrier to entry. And that means that fees are inevitably squeezed. And that's why I think it is important that we do create other opportunities and we do seek to, you know, make sure that the standards within the industry are maintained, and we look for to create opportunities, whether it be through the HCR or through EPCs for buildings other than dwellings.
Okay, Brian, thanks for that. Got another question again by Kathy, who asks, given the apparent Quest requirement to be certified through BRE or others, which has forced many people to accredit with more than one body, would Sava consider negotiating a deal so that NHER accredited DEAs can get work through Quest without the second accreditation?
Absolutely. I mean, we're very keen that Quest provides the link through to the NES1 site for so that people can access the NHER report writer. To be honest, it's kind of frustrating that we're in this situation as we started discussions with Quest ages and ages ago, and at one point we were making some significant progress in that direction. They then entered into an arrangement with BRE where they're the preferred technology partner, and that has kind of put everything on hold. But we are in discussions with them again, and we are hopeful that that they will do that. I mean, it's not in anyone's interest that the costs for a DEA to operate are higher than they need to be. So, yes, we are very keen. We understand that at the moment there's a workaround where just the RRN for the report can get entered via the Quest system, but we know that that isn't a preferred approach for some of the HIT providers using the Quest system, and we hope that we'll be able to reach an agreement with Quest to get past that at some point in the not too distant future. But I'm afraid I can't promise on timetable. I just don't know.
She also goes to ask to confirm if Sava NHER will definitely be running courses for the commercial qualifications, and if they are open to all, or sorry, if they are open to everybody, or if a DEA qualification is required.
Right. We will be running training courses. Yes, that is definitely our intention. There'll be a range of training courses depending on what level of accreditation people are seeking. We're not yet entirely clear as to whether the dominant route is going to be through training leads to a qualification, which is then used as a basis for signing up with an accreditation scheme, which is a kind of arrangement people are familiar with for the DEA and the home inspectors, or whether it will be that the training is undertaken and then individuals apply directly to an accreditation scheme, and the training is part of the evidence that they provide for an accreditation process. It's a little esoteric as to what the distinction is, but basically direct accreditation is not portable from one scheme to another, and that's its main disadvantage, whereas qualification route tends to be more time-consuming and more expensive, but it is portable between accreditation schemes. So we think we'll be offering both routes for individuals, and we think we'll be looking at accreditation schemes for simpler buildings and the slightly more complex ones that are still assessed using SBEM. And we expect to be doing new build with SBEM as well. We don't have any expectation of getting into either accreditation or training linked to the most complex buildings, which are assessed using the dynamic simulation models.
Okay. Do you have any ballpark figures you can quote?
No. Sorry, it's too early. But the only thing I can say is that we are not looking at a one-size-fits-all approach. We're looking at a pick-and-mix menu items, so that there will be short courses dealing with the different elements of the technical knowledge required, and if an individual needs all of them, then there'll be a package price. But there might be some individuals out there who are perfectly knowledgeable about the construction types for commercial buildings and don't feel they need that training. There might be others who are very familiar with the lighting that's used in commercial buildings and therefore don't want that part of the training. So we're trying to take a more modular approach to it this time around.
Okay. She's put in a lot of questions. You're getting a good score out of this, Kathy. Regardless of what the BX currently pay, what fee do you think an average EPC merits in the marketplace? I think you already answered that in a way, because you did originally think it was going to be 75 quid, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, what we said was, what I said, and this was never company policy, it was just sort of my own view, was that £75 as a fee was what I expected would be operating from the 1st of June. And then I said, the most likely direction of travel from there was down, although it might be affected by demand for the home condition report and the timing of the introduction of the requirement for EPCs for rental properties. But fundamentally, the value something has is what the market is prepared to pay. We all have seen the way prices for all sorts of products and services change over time. Whether it be trainers and the price people are paying for trainers, or whether it be the groceries we buy day in, day out, or the price we pay for someone to come around and do gas safety checks or anything else, that they are all controlled by market forces, and prices go up and down depending on supply and demand. At the moment we're seeing very high numbers of DEAs coming in, far higher than anybody expected for a market that is extremely limited. As we see the rental sector kick in, as we see the fuller rollout of HIPs, that will change. But it is inevitable that some individuals are going to look at it and say, I'm not going to be able to realize the fees that I was expecting. I'm going to pull out of this market. And that affects the overall supply and demand equation. People's expectations were very different. Some people qualify as a DEA thinking, well, if I can earn 20 to 25,000 a year, that's perfectly fine. Others responded to newspaper articles saying that they can earn 80 or 100,000 a year, and that's their salary expectations. And we just don't know where the market is going to settle down to, and I'm not convinced that there is an intrinsic right level. I just don't know how you would go about defining such a thing.
I just want to get through this final question that she's put here, which basically says, do you think it's time that training providers now limit the availability of courses so that those that have already qualified have an element of protection?
Yeah, this is one that I find I absolutely understand why somebody would suggest it, but I find it no more acceptable to suggest it at this stage than I found it acceptable when chartered surveyors were saying we shouldn't allow anyone to do home condition reports other than chartered surveyors. You know, I fought long and hard to allow for the creation of home inspectors when we expected that would be a mandatory thing. When the home condition report was made voluntary and it was just the EPC, there were voices saying, well, you know, only home inspectors should be allowed to produce EPCs. And there were other voices saying, no, it should be chartered surveyors that are producing EPCs. I mean, basically, I'm not a great... I don't believe that restricting the supply of individuals to a market is ever a good thing from a consumer's point of view. Yes, it might be beneficial from the point of view of the individuals that are in the market, but I don't believe that it's in the long-term interests of consumers. And because, you know, something that is bad for consumers in the long term is bad for the participants in that market. So I don't believe it's in the long-term interests of the DEAs either. And, you know, the reality is that supply and demand means that there are, you know, demand for training courses for people to become DEAs has pretty much collapsed. You know, there are relatively small numbers of people now signing up for training courses. But there will always be some individuals for whom it makes eminent sense, whether it's because they work within an estate agent who's decided to bring the work in-house, or whether it's because somebody lives in a geographical area that's currently does have work available to it, or whether it's because they work within a social housing provider who's saying, well, actually, we've got this obligation to bring EPCs into our housing stock, therefore we want to bring some expertise in-house. I just don't think... you know, setting aside the question of legality, which I kind of doubt whether it is actually legal to prohibit people from training, I just don't think it is appropriate. And I know that is hard on the people who are already trained, but I don't think it's in their long-term interests that we try and use a sort of a planned economy approach to managing this activity.
Believe it or not, I can empathise with that view. I think the problem really is the delayed rollout, because the general populace believe that there aren't enough DEAs, that there's a big demand for them, and that's been fuelled by the adverts that are going out from the training providers saying that there is a demand for DEAs, and hey, you can earn £80,000 a year just by doing two a day. It's built up a backswell of people.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we are in a very unusual situation that people trained in anticipation of a market, and you know, that means that we didn't have the normal supply and demand feedback that we all rely on when making judgments about whether or not we spend our money on something. You know, there were a lot of stories flying around about there was going to be a desperate shortage. And I don't think anybody actually had a handle on just how many individuals were in training. And if that information had been in the marketplace, I'm sure it would have made quite a difference to the decisions that a lot of people were making. But I no more had access to that information than anybody else. I mean, I was astonished when some of the figures started to appear as to how many people were actually in training.
Well, at least there's one thing that's come out of this is the fact that you've basically said that the market has collapsed for training, so that should...
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly from our point of view, you know, yes, we are still taking, we've still got a small, relatively small numbers of people signing up, but none of them are operating under the illusion that that there's a desperate shortage of DEAs. I mean, that is not the case. I mean, the issue about fees, we have always been, or I have always been, extremely reluctant to get pushed on what fees people were going to be able to earn, because there was always so much speculation on it. But you do get kind of asked about it endlessly, and it's kind of, what's the right balance? And all one can say is you an honest opinion at the time that you get asked the question. But the situation has changed enormously compared to where we were really just a few short months ago.
Okay. Here's a question I had from an anonymous person, and this relates to what you were going on about with fees. How can Sava BX justify charging £120 for an EPC and only pay out £60? Now, there is a rumour that you charge your clients £120. I don't know how true that is, and I don't suspect that you will tell us, but let's talk about the £60.
Well, I'm perfectly happy to tell you. I mean, you know, our current pricing for customers that give us, you know, a single job would be £99, and the vast majority of our work goes to clients who are giving us far higher volumes of work than that, and it's significantly less than £99. You know, very significantly less than £99. So, it isn't true that we are receiving £120 a job and paying out £60. It never has been true, and that's kind of as far as I can go. We took a judgment that £60 was a realistic fee that we were going to be able to continue to pay. In practice, you know, even that's now under huge pressure. Yes, we courted controversy by being honest about where we saw things going earlier than anybody else. But it's already the case that there are lots of organizations paying a lot less than we do. The business exchange is being undercut day in, day out by organizations going out and trying to poach our clients, trying to attract work from HIP providers at fees significantly less than we are charging, despite the fact that our fees are significantly less than £99 in the vast majority of our work. You know, people are charging £70 and less to HIP providers. Well, you know, I don't know what that translates into in terms of a fee for the DEA, but it's a heck of a lot less than £60.
When I spoke with Greg Elliott a couple of months ago now, I guess, of SP Properties, we talked about, well, I threw the question out as to how much people have invested in so far into becoming a DEA, even including those people that started out 2 years ago that wanted to be a home inspector. Mm-hmm. And figures range from £4,000 up to £30,000 and growing, because let's face it, each week you're not earning and sat at home twiddling your thumbs is another week lost and another week of cost. Then you've got ongoing costs with the extra insurance of your car, you've got to buy equipment, software, insurances and computers and all the rest of it. And then, of course, we've got the training for commercial coming up as well and the CPDs. Is £60 enough to keep in business?
Well, for some individuals, yes. For other individuals, no. It depends on what their expectations are. It's going to depend on where they are and what the volumes of work are. But fundamentally, if there was sufficient work that one could actually hit the levels of activity you needed, you could make a full-time job out of it. £60 a job would actually be quite good earnings. If you're working on the basis that, there's one job a day, well, no, it's completely and utterly inadequate. But I can't, in a sense, I can't change that, because the actual forces that we're all dealing with don't allow me to. If I was to turn around and say, well, we're going to pay all of our DEAs £100, well, it would be really simple because we wouldn't have any work. we would be closing up shop within 24 hours. The biggest challenge I've got in fees terms is sustaining the £60 and resisting the pressure to actually bring our prices down and bring our fees down. The only answer to it is to drive up the volume of activity. Without more activity, the debate about fees is a completely meaningless one. Because, at the current levels of activity, there simply isn't enough work for anybody to make, there will be very few individuals and even fewer businesses with a sustainable model based on the current volume of activity.
It is volume, definitely. Final question from Dan Walters. What is the number of hours required of CPD to comply with accreditation?
Right, I've got to separate here between home inspectors and DEAs. For DEAs, there isn't a minimum CPD requirement, but there may be mandatory CPD that comes along during the course of the year. For example, if there was a serious revision to our DSAP at some point, but there may be a mandatory CPD requirement. We introduced the CPD for the social housing sector, and anybody wishing to use sampling and cloning, we made it a requirement that they'd gone through that CPD. But in terms of general, if RDSAP didn't change during the course of the year, if nothing new came in like the social housing work, there wouldn't be a mandatory number of hours of CPD for a DEA. But clearly there is a kind of, you want to keep developing your skills, and that then becomes a kind of how are you keeping up to date in terms of development. That is slightly different for home inspectors, where there is an expected number of hours of CPD per year, and I can't remember what it is. It's something like 10 or 12 hours of CPD per year. But again, if anyone has questions about that, they can get in touch directly with the accreditation scheme or the certification scheme, depending on whether it's a DEA or an HI.
Out of interest, Brian, would listening to you on this podcast count towards your CPD?
I think we seek to validate that somebody has learned something from their CPD. I think only if we created an exam to see whether or not they had actually picked anything up from it. But we are keen that CPD is linked to the development of individuals' technical skills, and that's why we're kind of reluctant to put it as you've got to do X hours of this, but reading a journal counts or anything like that. We'd much rather see a lower threshold, but linked to valid development of an individual's skills and knowledge.
So if people hold their own little group CPD course in a pub, does that qualify towards CPD?
The question is, how can you validate that individuals sort of developed more knowledge and skill as a result of taking part in that process. And, you know, it's still very early days in this, and we want to encourage people to carry on with the sort of study groups that sort of developed whilst people were candidates. And I think, it is a good thing if HIs and DEAs do get together and sort of exchange experience and learn from that. In order for something to be validated CPD, we would normally look for some sort of assessment of has that CPD achieved some goals in terms of adding to the knowledge or skills of the individual.
Okay, Brian, I thank you for your time on this. Finally, we just reached the point where we ask guests to pimp their sites. So this is an opportunity for you to pimp your site and any contact details you want to leave.
Oh, right. If people start from the www.nesltd.co.uk or from the NHER site, which is www.nher.co.uk, or the SAVA one, which is www.sava.org.uk. And, we do have a whole range of different sites and services, and we're always keen to hear from people as to what services they would like to see us providing and what more we can do to support them. But I can't suddenly change the world and make the volumes of work increase or the prices that clients pay go up. We're one of a whole range of different players in the market, I'm afraid.
Well, I thank you for your time and your candid answers to those questions. We overextended our stay. I'll probably have to split this into two, I think. And don't forget, if everyone is urged to contribute to the survey, put your name on it, send it off, and let's try and put some pressure on the government to get this thing rolled out as soon as possible. Other than that, any last word, Brian?
No, I wish everybody well. I wish that we all had, or that I had better news that I could give to people, but, it is a very difficult situation, and I don't think we're going to see the government improving our collective lot anytime soon without some real pressure being brought to bear, and that does require the involvement of everybody that wants to see this succeed, and we're going to try and do our level best, but we need everybody's engagement with it, and we'd like to see 5,000 signatures on that petition, and we'd like to see 5,000 people willing to stand outside CLG and tell them exactly what we think of their failure to actually act.
Well, I'll echo that. Come on, people. This is your last chance, really. If you want to get something done by Christmas, just get on this. I know there's been a petition fest late in the last few months, but really, you've got to make this one count. So stand up and be counted. Brian, thanks once again. Pleasure to speak with you, and hopefully we can get you back on sometime in the future. We wish you all the very best, and until next week, everybody, let me bid you goodbye.
Thanks a lot, Mike. Bye-bye.
You're listening to
the DEA Podcast.
Podcast at energy-performance-certificate.org.
You like that?